Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this our Salute to Sanders Brown Center on Aging show because from Sanders Brown Center, we have two of their most renowned and experienced scientists. First of all, an associate professor from the Department of Pharmacology and Nutritional Sciences, Elizabeth Head. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Good morning, Tony.
And also, Dr. Frederick Schmidt, who is professor of neurology, psychiatry, and psychology and behavioral science. Hello, Fred.
Tony, good to see you.
Thanks to our listeners at the newly refurbished True Talk Internet Radio. My co-medical host, Rick Phillips, is on assignment in Isomville this week because some people simply do not know how to listen to orders. Our website, www.wmky.org, there's where you go to listen to our show. We've got MP3s of the past probably a couple of years' shows now. You can look, point out mistakes, write them down, make a list, perhaps even start a spreadsheet of all the mistakes we make, and send it to us when you're finished. Where would you send it? You would send it to us at HM Radio Show on Facebook. That's where we welcome feedback, viewer comments, and we will also post articles and the list to next week's show. Now, Liz, I was excited. I was thinking about driving over here, all the questions I had after reading a little bit about your biography. And so I will just let's get started and try to work our way through this. You were born in Canada.
I was. I was born in Timmins, Canada, and that's where Shania Twain was born.
And, you know, that was not even on my list of questions. So, you know, I got to be careful here because Shania Twain is might be a few years older than you. And so I've got to think this through carefully. Did you know her? Do you know her family?
No, I did not. I think actually I left Timmins well before she came about.
And then on to the University of Toronto for college. Did you at that time, were you interested in scientific research or how did you become interested in what you do now?
Most of my interest really came from my father. My father was an immigrant from Germany and he wanted to go to school and he wanted to become a scientist or a doctor. And he tried very hard to do that, but because of having two small children, it was a challenge. All that to say, we used to have a lot of conversations about science. We read science fiction books together and that really got me going on this line.
And what was your, as a child, what was your thought about being a scientist? What did you want to do?
I wanted to be a brain scientist right from the start. In fact, I have a cute little project I did in grade 6 or it was all about the brain. I was always fascinated by the brain.
And then after, again, degrees at the University of Toronto, you did wind up, I believe, postdoc at Irving. Is that California Irving? Is that right?
The University of California at Irvine, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how did you come to California?
Part of that stemmed from the work I did for my PhD, which was to work with old beagles and try to develop treatments that would make them healthier and hopefully take that to people. So most of my work was on measuring learning and memory in dogs and how to do that very systematically. By natural extension, the group at the University of California was looking at the brains of old dogs, but not looking at their learning and memory ability. So it was natural for me to go to California and learn anatomy.
Okay. Now for those of you listeners, you may be in your car, there may be a fan running or something like that. She said old dogs. Yes, she has been researching memory problems in old dogs. Now, how did you discover that as a way of getting your PhD?
We were approached. There was a drug that was being marketed for Parkinson's disease, and the person who purchased the rights to distribute this in Canada also thought, and I'm not sure how he came to this, that this could also be a good treatment for old dogs. And he thought about the vet population and how much people care about their old dogs. And that set me on the path to my thesis work, which is how do we measure learning and memory, and does it change as dogs get older?
Can you briefly tell us how you do measure memory in a dog?
Sure. So what we do is we give them objects to look at, and we ask them to remember where had they seen this object or do they remember having seen that specific object. And every time they get an answer right, they get a food reward. So with repeated training, we can measure how long can animals remember this information. And the tests are very much like what we do with people in the clinic. They're very analogous.
And is it very similar to people that some dogs seem to be very, very have very good memories as older and others don't?
It's almost frighteningly similar in that about a third of our old dogs show a memory impairment. And a third are a little bit slower, but they get there. And then we have a subset of old dogs that are just as smart and as quick as young dogs.
I'm going to go ahead and ask this, because when I read about this, I wondered. There is a smell test that has been touted as a possible test for Parkinson's disease in people. Do beagles lose their sense of smell more if they are becoming demented?
You know, we have not evaluated that directly, because what we have to do to get our animals to work using only visual information, we have to discourage them from using their noses. So we've never directly asked that question, but that's a really interesting test in the clinic.
Well, I would think so. And I will say, you know, we can, as a matter of fact, guys, we can open up on this pretty much any time. There are so many tests that have been touted as tests for Alzheimer's disease. And I just last week read that perhaps hearing loss. And I think about all the people as they get older with hearing loss and how hard that would be to sort. But the loss of a sense of smell, there is, in fact, I believe, a Pittsburgh smell test that actually measures the sense of smell. And supposedly, at least in some trials, that has been a predictor of development of Alzheimer's disease. Now, keep in mind, I'll give you an example. My wife uses a nasal steroid spray because of allergies. If you've had sinus surgery, if you happen to like spicy foods, there are a lot of things that can have an effect on the acuity of your sense of smell other than Alzheimer's disease. And I don't think that test is ready for prime time. Freddie, are you using it, or what are you doing with that test right now?
Actually, we're not using it as an Alzheimer's test. The loss of sense of smell is very common in all kinds of neurologic disorders, and it is common in normal aging. There was some research done here at the University of Kentucky by a research team, Tom and Marilyn Getchell, that actually investigated that. And we asked 300 people who are part of our volunteer group to do the smell test. And what makes this a true test of whether it detects Alzheimer's is these are people who donate their brain when they die. So we were actually able to look at their change in sense of smell over time, over years, and then look at the Alzheimer's proteins in their brain. And the association was not strong enough to make this a usable test.
In humans. Now, beagles, there's still a possibility. But again, you will hear many, many tests, everything from genetic tests to brain scans and so forth. And still, we'll get into this more in the show, but still, from a clinical standpoint, we still have some work to do. Back to the beagles. You're in California. You got the beagle anatomy. You came from Toronto. For some reason, you came to Kentucky.
Right. So when I was at the University of California, I got to know a pediatric neurologist. His name was Dr. Ira Lott. And Ira had been working with people with Down syndrome for many, many, many years. And part of what I learned at UCI was not only about animal beagle anatomy, but also human brain anatomy. And I became engaged in the Alzheimer's Center there. So to pursue my goal of working with people with Down syndrome, one of the natural extensions was to come to the University of Kentucky, because Dr. Marksberry had developed this beautiful center that had all the resources and all the wonderful people I needed to continue my work.
So, you know, we've seen among our researchers a lot of different reasons for coming to Kentucky. Again, when you develop a center of excellence, such as Sanders Brown is, you can expect to attract top scientists just for the science. And now, admittedly, Lexington's a nice place to live. We are neither on fire nor having earthquakes right now, so a very reassuring place to live for many people, but also a great place to do work on aging in general and on Alzheimer's disease in particular. And that's what got us Dr. Head. And again, we do really appreciate your work here, and I know we'll get into a little bit more when you mention about Down syndrome kids. Make sure that we talk about that. But Fred, you followed, I would have to say, a slightly different path to the University of Kentucky than Liz did. First of all, Rensselaer Polytechnic in Troy, New York. That I have some friends who are engineers. This is a top, for those of you who are not familiar with the school, a top, absolutely top engineering school. And yet you're not an engineer. So how did you get interested in science and then interested in medical research?
Well, this is a long and convoluted story, but there is a picture of me at the age of three in Harrodsburg, at Fort Harrod, underneath that very odd tree. And maybe that was kind of looking into the future as to why I'd end up in Lexington and in Kentucky. I'm originally from Cincinnati, so it wasn't a far cry. And I had actually been accepted to go to Center College and was looking forward to come to Center College as a biology and pre-med major, and was whisked away to upstate New York mainly because they gave me a better scholarship. So money talks. And so I went to Rensselaer, was in the six-year MD program, and found that working with a fellow who was doing electrode implants, brain surgery on animals to discover the root basis of seizures and epilepsy, caught my fancy. And that just stayed with me from there on out. I ended up in Northeast Ohio for my graduate training, worked with several people who were interested in the development of the brain. So we were looking at how does the brain develop from children and then to older adults. Interestingly, my interest was to stay in the pediatric realm. We did work with people with Down syndrome, and in those days, people with Down syndrome didn't generally make it out of their 20s or 30s. They didn't live that long because of all of the additional medical challenges that they have. And so naturally, we started applying the work we were doing with children and how their memory develops and how their thinking develops. We were asked to take the same approach to how memory is lost as people get older. And as a result, I ended up at a place that a lot of people in Kentucky don't like to hear, a place called Duke for my fellowship, was able to spend a number of years at Duke learning about neuroscience, neurology, and psychiatry. I had my first job at another place that people in Kentucky don't like to hear about, which is University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And because there was not enough good bourbon there, I ended up coming to Lexington to UK because it was a better basketball program, even though I had free tickets in North Carolina.
We're going to give our radio fans just a few minutes to settle down and contemplate the fact that good things can come out of Duke University. Why don't you take a break, and we will too.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
And welcome back. You're listening to Health Matters. This is our Salute to the Sanders Brown Center on Aging show. This is the second fractional portion. I'm your host, Dr. Tony Weaver. With me from the University of Kentucky is Dr. Elizabeth Head, who is associate professor with the Department of Pharmacology and Nutritional Sciences at the University of Kentucky Sanders Brown Center on Aging. Welcome back, Liz.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Frederick Schmidt, who's professor of neurology, psychiatry, psychology, and behavioral science at the University of Kentucky. Hi, Fred.
Hey.
Our sponsor for the second time, the Sons and Daughters of Patients with Alzheimer's and Related Dementia, reminding you their Stand Upwards motto is it beta amyloid clusters and plaques or combined with tau protein that gets you off track? And their Alzheimer's disease myth. Memory loss is a natural part of aging. No, it is not. It is, in fact, a result of several different disease processes, Alzheimer's disease being one of them. Myth number two, dementia and Alzheimer's disease are the same thing. See myth number one. No, that is not true. There are many other reasons why people would become more confused or would lose their cognitive abilities or their memory. Myth number three, Alzheimer's disease is not fatal. Unfortunately, it is. It is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. And of the top six, the only one that we really do not have any treatments for. When you think about heart disease, you think about cancer, you think about strokes, you think about respiratory disease, we at least have treatments that modify them or ways to prevent them. And although we are working on some ways to prevent Alzheimer's disease, we really don't have effective treatments at this point. Myth number four, we talked about last time, only older people get Alzheimer's. And again, there are 200,000 people younger than age 65 with younger onset Alzheimer's disease. Myth number five, I think this has been put to bed, but I will just mention it. Drinking out of aluminum cans or cooking in aluminum, there's still that theory that the metal aluminum has some pots. And Fred, I know you're shaking your head, and I'll let you speak, but let me just say, I worked on some heavy metal stuff in college, and I remember our standards, the solutions we used to standardize our machine came wrapped in aluminum foil. This, one of the reasons why this persisted is this is a darn hard thing to research, but I think the research is conclusive. What do you think?
There are still people who believe aluminum is involved in Alzheimer's disease and other heavy metals. But right now, the definitive research was effectively done here in Lexington. Bill Amon, who was a faculty member here, along with Bill Marksberry and other colleagues, did what I consider to this point, the most definitive study. They used autopsy tissue of people with Alzheimer's disease, and they used what's known as a laser probe. And so they used this laser probe to study the heavy metals in the brain. And they found that aluminum levels were there, but they were no different from those people who did not have Alzheimer's. To follow up on that, they also did a study looking at mercury, along with one of the dentists here, Dr. Stan Sachs. And in this study, they actually took pictures of people's amalgams, their dental fillings. And based on that, they could tell, depending on how people chew and so forth, that mercury is released from those dental fillings. And everybody was worried that mercury is now the toxic substance. And to this day, everybody's arguing about mercury in vaccines and mercury in fish. Yes, it is dangerous if you get high quantities, but does it cause Alzheimer's? And again, they used a similar technique. They studied how much mercury you got exposed to. Then they went and they looked at the brain tissue and they found, again, there was no difference. So if you're not seeing more mercury in the brain of people with Alzheimer's versus those who don't have it, the same with aluminum, the odds are that that's not a causative part.
So in one fell swoop, Fred takes out myth number 5 and myth number 7. I'll go myth number 6 was about flu shots. And again, I think this has also been put to bed. The encouraging thing is I think there are many things that are irrational right now. And if you just look at the TV or follow the political campaigns, but the irrational fear of vaccination seems to be fading somewhat. Vaccination rates are up and categorically we've looked at getting flu shots. And in fact, I will say it again, this is, people have heard me say this over and over again, this is Mother Nature with a 25-gauge needle. If we introduce a dead flu virus and rev your immune system up, that is much better than nature introducing a live flu virus, which could kill you. Physicians have very, very little patience with people who resist these known vaccines, and certainly Alzheimer's disease is not one of the side effects of any type of vaccination. That is our sponsor again, the myths of Alzheimer's disease from the sons and daughters of patients with Alzheimer's and related dementia. Now, when we left our first fractional portion, Fred was explaining, and again, just very quickly, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute got a good scholarship there. I am very, very impressed with that institution. Is turning out top scientists in the first place. Goes to, has done some work in Akron, Ohio, which we can live with, but then goes to Durham, North Carolina, in what has to be one of the low points of his life, does postdoctoral studies there. But then, fortunately, I don't know, it was a 12-step intervention, not really sure what happened. He comes to Lexington, Kentucky. And Fred, again, I'll ask the same question I asked Liz. What attracted you to Lexington, and how did you get here?
It's very, very straightforward. It was the Sanders Brown Center on Aging. They had just gotten federal funding to study Alzheimer's disease. And I was studying Alzheimer's disease in Durham and was part of the effort there. But I needed to find a more supportive environment. So my interest was, how does the brain change as we get older? I knew how the brain changed clinically. I mean, I could see patients and I could test their memory, but I needed to know what was going on between their ears. And in those days, we didn't have a lot of brain imaging tools. So the answer was, look at the brain under the microscope. And Bill Marksberry, who was head of the center at the time, was one of the main reasons that I came here. He and the other scientists who had just put together this Alzheimer's Center gave me that opportunity.
Now, you first of all, I know you mentioned basketball jokingly in the last fractional portion, but a guy that goes to Duke and Kentucky, you have to at least have a passing interest in basketball.
I do, and one of the biggest hurdles, which almost led me to go somewhere else, and I won't mention where, was when I interviewed here. And Bill Marksberry, having played for Coach Rupp when he was an undergrad, we talked sports. He also was a pro baseball pitcher. He actually pitched for the Cincinnati Reds and made it up all the way to AAA. So he and I had a lot in common. I played football in college. I wrestled. I played baseball. So we were kind of sports fanatics. So I asked him very upfront, and I said, so part of the deal of me coming here to work here, I can get basketball tickets, right? Because I kind of have some, you know, that I'm given back where I'm from here in North Carolina. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, Fred, one thing you have to learn, God can't get tickets.
You had tickets, but let's go back to the main point. You had tickets at Cameron Indoor.
No, I was given tickets.
Okay, I gotcha. If you were a season ticket holder at Cameron Indoor, the show ends right now. I'm sorry, but we can't come back from that. Now, obviously, again, going if you consider Rensselaer, you were interested in science from an early age as well, just like Liz was. What about it, though? What attracted you to neurology and to dementias and Alzheimer's disease?
So part of it comes from the fact of my early studies on brain development. You know, we knew at the time that children's brains develop differently. There are gender differences in how fast we develop our language. Back in the 70s, there were all these arguments about what are men better at, what are women better at. And so how the brain works became a fascination to me. And we did animal research in those days. I worked with monkeys. And we tried to teach monkeys new tricks. Unlike Liz, I cannot teach an old dog a new trick, but she can, I understand. So we worked with monkeys. We worked with children. And then one day, somebody called me and said, I have a person who's in their 80s, and they are driving me crazy. And you're a memory expert. Would you come look at them? And I said, sure. And so I met this person, this lady in Cleveland, who couldn't remember from 1 minute to the next what was going on. And again, this is the 1970s, and we didn't really know about Alzheimer's disease. And everybody said, she's got hardening of the arteries. That was how we explained dementia in those days. And I became fascinated by what she could and couldn't remember. She couldn't remember recent things, but she could remember all about her life. She could remember where she lived. She could remember her address. But she couldn't remember my name, even though I introduced myself every 5 minutes. That became a fascination. So we were looking at how memory develops in children and in animals. And then suddenly, here was a person whose memory wasn't working. What a neat way to try to piece together how the brain works when you have part of the brain not working.
So you went to obviously that part then clinically fascinated you, and I understand that. Between personal experiences with relatives who have dementia, my own increasing forgetfulness, which as a physician you always let me ask both of you right here, right now, Fred, what are you doing to protect your memory?
So the evidence is limited, but the best things that we can think of is keep your heart healthy. What's good for the heart is good for your head. That's an old saying, and there's nothing better than that. So you have to watch your diet. You have to exercise. And more importantly, why am I still here with all my gray hair at UK? Because I'm learning things. You got to keep learning. And the more you learn, the more connections you make in your brain. And the research suggests that the more connections and the more you learn, the more resistant your brain is to the symptoms of Alzheimer's.
You know, unfortunately, that means that a lot of us, as we get older, get more comfortable doing the same routine. We sort of feel familiar. That, unfortunately, is not the right thing to do. And so we have to stretch ourselves a little bit, get into situations where we may feel uncomfortable. Liz, I'll ask you the same question. How are you protecting your brain?
I think many of the same things that Fred talked about is what I'm trying to do. It's hard to get exercise when you're busy and you're bound to your desk. I think another really important thing that I love doing and I think is also good for my brain is being around people. Being socially active, talking to people, I think that's very, very good for your brain. So, and I also am very fond of red wine, which apparently is also very protective for aging, and I'm on board with that.
I am not a particular red wine drinker. I have green tea in front of me, as many of our radio fans know. We're all trying something, and we'll see how that works out. Fred, then I think this leads us forward. Then you became interested in working with Down syndrome. Kids, or I guess adults, really.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So again, this dates back to the 70s. Part of the work we were doing with how does memory develop, we were looking at children who had normal development, children without Down syndrome versus children with intellectual disability, with Down syndrome being a key. And my major professors had trained with some of the early developmental psychologists who studied Down syndrome. So we were able to do some Down syndrome work looking at can we train people with Down syndrome to learn specific skills so that they can actually hold a job. And that was my early work. But what happened when I was at Duke is we had some research that suggested that the genetics of Down syndrome mimicked some of the changes we saw in Alzheimer's disease. And I was led to work with a fellow in up on Staten Island, two fellows actually, Henry Wisniewski and Art Dalton, two physicians who had a very specific interest in Alzheimer's but in Down syndrome. And they were doing autopsy work in Down syndrome and showing that in Down syndrome, the brain changed and looked just like Alzheimer's disease. And so it became a fascination to say we have people who are getting Alzheimer's at a younger age because of their genetics. And they're showing the same protein buildup, but we kind of knew that they would get these changes at by about age 35 or 40 in the brain. And then it was just a question of when would they show the clinical symptoms? When would we see the dementia? And that was the same question that was being asked in Alzheimer's disease in the general population. So the two kind of tied together because of the protein changes that we see in the brain of Alzheimer's patients and of people with Down syndrome who go on, not everybody, but many go on to develop dementia.
And you, I guess when you came to Kentucky, you began working with, again, local Down syndrome societies and groups as well?
Well, what we did when we came to Kentucky, we were focused mainly on, if you will, the general population of Alzheimer's disease. And every once in a while, we had somebody with Down syndrome in the area who whose family was kind enough to donate their body to science after they passed away. And we were able to make comparisons between the brains in these people with Down syndrome to those of our folks with Alzheimer's disease. Interestingly, back when I came to UK in the late 1980s, people with Down syndrome were not living long enough so that Alzheimer's was a big issue or a big problem. They were still living into their 30s, and it's only in the recent, say, 15 to 20 years that the lifespan has improved for people with Down syndrome so that we're seeing more and more people with dementia. So Down syndrome and Alzheimer's was actually a low priority for us in the early days until we started seeing more and more people with Down syndrome who developed the Alzheimer's changes.
You know, Down syndrome, again, trisomy 21, we call it. The 21st chromosome has three versions, and that causes a wide range of problems, not only the limited mental capacity, but also a high rate of heart disease. These people are born with a very high rate of heart disease. Thyroid disease and other conditions are more common. And so, in fact, the life expectancy, it really didn't matter whether you were looking at dementia or not, because, in fact, living to adulthood or certainly to old age was just not even an option for people with Down syndrome until we started addressing some of these other issues. And then you find, one, a challenge, but also a model, which I'm in the process of realizing is a pretty cool thing. Liz, can you tell us about this grant then that the two of you are working on right now?
So when I moved from the University of California here to the University of Kentucky, one of the key people I really wanted to work with was Fred. And within a year of arriving here, the NIH started to request proposals for studies that would look at people with Down syndrome as they get older to understand what cognitive changes are happening and how can we detect dementia in a group of people with intellectual disability. It can be a little challenging. And lots of families now are talking to the Alzheimer's Association saying, my son, daughter, brother, sister is showing changes in behavior and I don't know what to do. So within that year, Fred and I very, very quickly put together a proposal along with Brian Gold in our anatomy brain imaging section and Dave Powell. And we were very lucky in that we were one of only two proposals funded in the country in that round. And that got Fred and I started. And it's a real great collaboration because Fred brings all of the clinical expertise to this project. And I bring a lot of the brain studies, autopsy studies, molecular studies to the project. And between the two of us, it works out really great. And I've learned a lot now from Fred in terms of clinical changes and vice versa. So that's how we got started. And we've had a really great time with it. We have incredible families who have volunteered to participate, and they have stuck with us, and we thank them for that. And we are now moving into the second phase of our study because our grant was extended for another 5 years. And the reason we get these extensions or we get a renewal is based on how well we're doing in the first 5 years. So now we can follow people for up to 10 years, which is absolutely fantastic. So we're trying to recruit more people to come into our study. We have a little bit more money to bring in more, and we'd love for those families to come and contact us.
Well, let's go ahead and let's just talk about that a little bit more. You're looking for people who have family members or people with Down syndrome. And what ages are you looking at?
So we're asking people 25 years and older to consider joining us, and that can be self-advocates, a person with Down syndrome, or a family member can contact us, and we can go from there.
If you or someone you love has Down syndrome, you should consider being a part of this longitudinal study. I think you're getting close to 100 people in the group that you follow. Now, for a person who might be considering this, what type of things do you do for them or with them?
So I think part of it is the exciting aspect of being a part of the study. What do we do? First off, we talk to people. We check their memory and thinking. We do blood work because we want to make sure that if they are having changes or do develop changes, that it's nothing that is part of their metabolism change. One of the things that's been an advantage in the study is we've identified a number of people who've joined the study by doing the standard clinical blood work who have had thyroid problems, and they're getting treated now and are doing better. We then do brain scans, and these are really neat. You get beautiful pictures of the brain and how it's put together and how it's connected. And we even give our participants copies of those pictures when they're interested. And we also have a team of excellent neurologists over at the Kentucky Neuroscience Institute, including Dr. Greg Jaika and Dr. Bill Robertson, who's been in Kentucky forever and is well known for his work in pediatric neurology. And we have a new faculty member who's joined our team in Donita Leitner, who's also a wonderful pediatric neurologist. And they do a neurologic and medical workup. Again, trying to make sure that our folks are healthy and that we can study how the brain changes as they get older. In between, we give breaks, we have meals, and we see people once a year and go through the blood work, the memory and thinking tests, the medical exam, and then getting pictures of their brain.
They see you. They see their patients once a year. We will see you in our third and final fractional portion. Why not take a break? You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back. This is our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Tony Weir. This is our Salute to Sanders Brown Center on Aging show. And with us from the Sanders Brown Center, Dr. Elizabeth Head, who's Associate Professor at the Department of Pharmacology and Nutritional Sciences. Welcome back, Liz.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Frederick Schmidt, who's Professor of Neurology, Psychiatry, Psychology, and Behavioral Science. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
Our sponsor for the final time, the sons and daughters of patients with Alzheimer's and related dementia, that's Stand Upward. And their motto is, it beta amyloid clusters and plaques are combined with tau protein that gets you off track. We'll talk about that more in this fractional portion. But we have been working our way through 10 Alzheimer's disease myths. This was posted on MedicineNet.com June 2016, but these things have been around for a while. I'll just run through them quickly. Myth number one, memory loss is a natural part of aging. No, it is not. Many people can make it to an advanced stage with memory intact. Some people lose memory at a very young age. There are many conditions, many pathologies that lead to memory loss and cognitive loss of cognitive function, but aging is not one of them. Myth number two, dementia and Alzheimer's disease are the same thing. No, they are not. There are plenty of causes of memory loss and loss of brain function other than Alzheimer's disease. Some of them are reversible. It is important if someone you love is showing signs of memory loss and inability to think clearly to get that looked at, because even if Alzheimer's disease is not treatable, there are other causes that are. Myth number three, Alzheimer's disease not fatal. It is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. Myth number four, only older people get it. Again, we've talked about 200,000 people younger than age 65 with a younger onset Alzheimer's disease. Myth number five, six, and seven, aluminum causes Alzheimer's disease. Flu shots cause Alzheimer's disease. Dental amalgams cause Alzheimer's disease. Just put in your toxin of choice and say that causes Alzheimer's disease. So for those three, we've actually investigated, and again, much of that was done here at the University of Kentucky and found to not be true. But the others, there is right now no leading smoking gun toxin that we know is responsible for Alzheimer's disease. And as we mentioned, oddly enough, and in a strange way, with everything else, diabetes rates and other conditions skyrocketing, Alzheimer's disease incident rates around the world, there is some early evidence that they may be actually leveling off. This is very exciting. exciting. It might actually enable us to remain financially solvent for a while. There are a lot of implications of this, and we're all keeping our fingers crossed and hoping that this trend continues. Myth number 8, and we're in new ground now. There are treatments available to stop the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Now, again, some of the treatments we've got, Aricept, Exelon, Rezidine, and Namenda, seem to help with the symptoms, and they may make an unmanageable person maybe more manageable or delay some of the symptoms. But as far as the underlying damage to the brain, Fred, nothing's really changed there.
Nothing has changed.
And I know the UK group has tried antioxidants and vitamin E and several different supplements and not had any success either. I'm guessing that's what I understand.
That's correct.
Myth number 9, Alzheimer's disease can be prevented. Well, I mean, this is what I read on the internet. I will say, and you know, we talked about it, physical activity, especially heart healthy activity, not smoking, maintaining a good blood pressure, maintaining a healthy diet. That's what we know. Now, if you have a genetic mutation, well, let's talk about that a minute, because there are genetic mutations and then there are genetic mutations. Fred or Liz, either one of you, the genetics of Alzheimer's, we talk about ApoE4, which, and this is my comic book view, allows Alzheimer's disease to happen but does not necessarily cause it inevitably. But there are other mutations that actually do cause it inevitably. Can you enlighten us on that?
So really what we have there is two things going on. The apolipoprotein E4 allele, when you carry that allele, you get one or two from mom and dad, that you're at higher risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. But it's not a card that says you will get the disease. So even if you have that carrier, the APOE4 gene, it doesn't mean you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. In contrast, familial forms of Alzheimer's disease are a specific mutations on genes that lead to increased plaques in the brains of these folks. And that's why they typically develop it very young, in 30s and 40s. So it's quite devastating at that age, obviously. So there are two things that are going on there. And there are multiple other genetic risk factors that we're learning about by these massive gene-wide array studies, where we have tens of thousands of people enrolled in these studies. They provide some of their DNA samples. And we're finding other genes now that seem to be telling us a little bit more about who's at risk for developing Alzheimer's. It's important for us to figure this out because these genes could give us some insights into what new treatments or targets we should aim for.
And myth number 10, my parent had Alzheimer's, so that means I'll have it. And again, I think we just explained the genetics are much more complicated than that. Now, Fred, I'm going to ask you, invariably people will call and say, well, I need a test for Alzheimer's. What do you tell people when they want to get the Alzheimer test?
I tell them that it's going to take a while. The best we can do today is to get a good neurologic workup, which includes blood tests, it includes a neurologic exam, it includes memory and thinking tests. So they might get to see me, and I put them through a couple of mental calisthenics, and often we will do a brain scan. So it's a full neurologic press, if you will, to try to make sure that their memory symptoms don't have an underlying cause, like a vitamin deficiency, which is very common, or an infection, which is very common, and that the brain is actually healthy. So there's nothing going wrong in the brain, like small vessels in the brain are breaking down, or there was a stroke, say, while you were asleep that you didn't notice, or there's a brain tumor that's coming in. And one of the fascinating things about that workup is that we see that Alzheimer's is linked back to what we didn't like in the early 1970s and 80s. It is linked somewhat to heart health and health of the blood vessels. There's a lot of effort now looking at blood vessel health, which is why, again, that saying of what's good for the heart is good for the head makes a lot of sense. So the workup is a standard medical workup. You get to spend about 20 minutes in a brain scan. You spend about 20 minutes to an hour with a neurologist. And then you get to spend a couple hours having your memory and thinking checked. All of that gets put together. And we're right somewhere 7 or 8 times out of 10 when we say it's Alzheimer's disease.
So listen to this and wake up your family members now, because we know that Health Matters is very soporific. But when you talk about an Alzheimer test, there is not a test that exists, neither genetic nor a test that you get from your blood, nor some type of scan or anything else. What Fred is talking about is testing the structure of your brain with a brain scan and the function of your brain with a complete examination and memory testing and looking for other possible terrible things that may be affecting the brain. What he is not talking about is simply sending a blood sample off that will be back in 2 weeks and tell you whether or not you have or are going to have Alzheimer's disease. That test does not exist. So please, 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 if you get nothing else from this program, get that. That is an important take-home message from our program. That is our sponsor, Sons of Daughters of Patients with Alzheimer's and Related Dementia. And their motto is that beta amyloid clusters and plaques are combined with tau protein to get you off track. Now, when we left our last fractional portion, we were talking about their Down syndrome study. And I will remind you, if you or someone you love has Down syndrome, is over age 25, and would like to be a part of an ongoing study. Now, this is not a one and done. This is a once a year review of your brain function, of your brain structure, the things that they were talking about to help understand why people with Down syndrome get dementia at an earlier age. If you or someone you love is interested in that, you should contact them. And is there a particular way they can get in touch?
There's a couple of ways. One, they can just call the Center on Aging, 323-6040. That's an area code of 859. Or they can go to the website. They can go to the Sanders Brown website and click on the Down Syndrome and Aging Study button, and they can connect with all of the people in the study. In fact, what's interesting, if they go to the website, the Sanders Brown website, they will, and to the Down Syndrome study, they will find pictures of what we're finding. They'll find copies of papers that have already resulted from the research. They will find details of everything that we do in the study and how it's beneficial for them potentially, as well as for other people with Down syndrome.
So that, again, we will link to that website on our Facebook page, Health Matters, so that will be available, that link as well. Now, Fred, there was one part of it that I know that you've had it for a long time, and you mentioned this briefly earlier. You've had an interest in being able to examine people and to look at them while they're alive, and then afterwards, after they die, to look at an autopsy study of their brain. I know you have been doing that for people with Alzheimer's disease. This is a part of the down, if they want, and explain that. This is a part of the Down syndrome study as well.
Yes. So the definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, regardless of whether it's in Down syndrome or in other individuals, is due to autopsy. We have to look at the autopsy tissue under the microscope so that we can look for the beta amyloid protein buildup, so that we can look for the tau protein buildup. And so in any longitudinal study, we always ask people to consider donating their brain after death so that we can do that definitive diagnosis and try to tie all of the information that we get from year to year and all the brain pictures we get and the changes we may or may not see. Can we tie all of this together? Because looking at those brain proteins under the microscope and looking at them biochemically, so doing a chemical analysis of the brain tissue, is going to help us find targets for treatment. That's really what was behind the current Alzheimer's therapies, those symptomatic therapies that you mentioned, Terry. Those are excellent. They came from those autopsy studies. It showed that acetylcholine levels were down, so we developed medicines to treat that. So that's where the autopsy comes in. It's optional. It's a great gift from our folks. We have over 1,000 people in the Lexington area who've consented to donate their brain when they die so that we can do those studies. We have people with Down syndrome who've also consented, and it is the greatest gift to science that I can think of.
Now, this sounds very much like the NFL studies looking for traumatic encephalopathy. Is this a similar idea?
Yes, it's a similar idea. So pro football players are donating their brain and their body to science so that we can understand the tau protein changes that come with serious blows to the head trauma and concussion that occur in football. And this is a very similar idea. In fact, the NFL brain bank, if you will, was born from the Alzheimer's centers where, you know, it's important to get the autopsy so we can actually look at the brain under the microscope and see where these proteins build up and then take a look back at that person's health history to see, are there any links to those proteins.
And let me just take one moment, and I'm climbing up on the soapbox right now, and I'm going to preach a little bit more. One, I want to point out two things. One is you always think about people doing science as spending solitary time in front of a computer, or maybe they've got a beaker and something bubbling in the background, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and they're there all by themselves. I want you to, if you want to, go to our website and listen to this show again and realize it is riddled with the names of other researchers all the way back to Dr. Marksberry, who brought these, his reputation and his work brought these two people here. Science is a very collaborative effort, and you notice the respect they have for their colleagues and the people they work with. It is not a solitary thing. The second thing I want to point out is the idea of research being done on what we call guinea pigs. If you look at the relationships that a researcher forms with a person with Down syndrome or a person with Alzheimer's disease that allow them to follow them throughout their life, no one can consider this to be a guinea pig type research. They do research with Down syndrome adults or with Alzheimer's adults and not on them. And I think that's an important thing. That research, first of all, it does benefit the people who get it. They get an expert neurologist, world famous researcher, giving the latest opinions on their condition and also looking for complications and other problems. They get access to some possible treatments that might be of benefit in the future. And then secondly, though, the benefit to society to start to understand the puzzle of Alzheimer's disease and to save future generations, which could include your own children, is something that is just invaluable. So I've said this over and over again, but research is not something that is done on people as guinea pigs. It is done with people. And this is a great example. I know reading your bio, Liz, the awards that you have won from the Down Syndrome Societies really made me feel good about the collaborative work that you guys have done. Final portion, just final thoughts here, really, as we've talked some about something called beta amyloid and tau protein, and I'm going to throw it out to both of you. If you can, we've got a couple of minutes left. Explain to our radio fans about beta amyloid and tau protein in general, what they contribute to Alzheimer's disease and brain damage.
So we know that of the familial genetic mutations, one of the major outcomes is an extra amount of this beta amyloid protein, and that's what's probably causing the early onset dementia. A similar process is happening in people with Down syndrome because they're making too much of this protein. Now, we know that certainly in Down syndrome, people first develop plaques, these beta amyloid plaques, and then later on the tau pathology happens. And then later on, the dementia may happen. So there seems to be a sequence of events. All that to say that there's a current hypothesis that beta amyloid is causing dementia. And so a lot of the clinical trials that are going on now are all about reducing or clearing this beta amyloid pathology from the brain. And one of the things that we're learning more than anything is that we have to start earlier and earlier and earlier. And indeed, additional things we're learning is that we need to look at all the comorbidities. If we can help people get healthier, control heart disease, hypertension, obesity, that always makes for a better brain as you get older. And that might be why some of our rates of dementia are starting to level off, is people are taking this into consideration now.
And again, with beta amyloid, I've heard that it is cleared by sleep. If you don't get enough sleep, it may accumulate. It may be accumulated due to an inflammatory problem. Perhaps there's a metabolic error. There is some interaction with the environment that causes it to build up. And, Fred, again, we were talking, having high levels of beta amyloid does not guarantee, any more than having a gene, does not guarantee you'll get Alzheimer's.
That's correct. We have these new PET scans, these scans where we can actually look at beta amyloid in the brain. And while we can see it, you can look at two people who have high levels of beta amyloid in the brain. One may be demented, the other is doing fine. And I think you bring up another important point that I think the listener should understand. Some of the other risks for Alzheimer's disease that are very strong that can be taken care of. One is sleep disordered breathing or obstructive sleep apnea. There is evidence that if you have this and it is untreated, your risk for Alzheimer's disease is 8 times more than that of a person who doesn't have sleep disordered breathing. And these studies have just come out in the last 2 years. Very treatable, but it's very common as people get older. And that's just one example of how you can reverse memory loss.
We've got to get off the air. I'd like to thank our guest, Elizabeth Head, Associate Professor, Department of Pharmacology and Nutritional Sciences at Sanders Brown Center on Aging at the University of Kentucky, and Dr. Frederick Smith, who's Professor of Neurology, Psychiatry, Psychology, and Behavioral Science, and also at the Sanders Brown Centers. Thanks to our WUKY Operations Manager, John Lamagi, our Summer Moorhead State Public Radio Producer, Tanner Boyd, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our toe-tapping Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire, WMKY.org for the shows, HM Radio Show on Facebook for comments and for links. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, if you or someone you love has Down syndrome, is over age 25, and is interested in contributing to an ongoing study of Alzheimer's dementia and Down syndrome, contact the Sanders Brown Center on Aging or check our page on Facebook for that contact information. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week. Make your brain more healthy and tune in next week for more entertaining information on health matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.